Hello there. This is co-host Patrick James Lynch just dropping in on you before the episode actually kicks off to remind our reoccurring listeners and inform any new listeners who are joining us here on episode 12. Hello. Thanks for joining us. That this episode is actually a special one-year anniversary best of year in review episode for two reasons. One, because that's a fun episode to do, and we've had a lot of great content come through here. We thought it'd be fun to put it all together and kind of take a look at the highlights from year one. But the second reason is a very practical one, and that is co-host Natalie DeLillo, soon to be Natalie Lynch, and I are actually about to go get married and go on our honeymoon. So by the time this episode comes out, we will be a wed couple. But that means that we are not available to record the most recent episodes. So the team, headed up by our project manager and editor, Andrew Gall, has been working on this special year-in-review episode for both of those two reasons, which I hope you enjoy. Actually, going through the first 11 episodes and considering all the different guests we've had, the topics we've covered, there's a lot of great content. So I think it should make for a nice year-in-review episode and something for us to to appreciate, to sit back and kind of appreciate the highlights. A couple other things I just want to mention, too. We do have four podcasts that Bloodstream Media, the network, produces, this being the flagship one, the Bloodstream podcast. There's also the Ask the Expert podcast, where clinical experts on bleeding disorders answer questions from me and questions from listeners on all things bleeding disorders. The Powering Through podcast that features live panel conversations on obstacles, challenges, and what it takes to overcome. And our newest series, which just launched last month with a three-episode special on von Willebrand disease, is called Bloodline. And Bloodline is a deep educational dive into the topics that matter most. So for our von Willebrand disease series, as I mentioned in the last episode of the Bloodstream podcast, we interviewed numerous patients, parents, and clinicians on what life with von Willebrand disease looks like, the comprehensive impact VWD has on someone's life, and not just the life of people here in the U.S., but also abroad in developed countries, as well as developing countries, men and women, type 1, 2, 3. So we got a nice wide array of life experience with VWD that enabled us to put together what I think is a very powerful three-episode series. So I'd encourage you to check out that Bloodline series, as well as the Powering Through podcast and Ask the Expert podcast, which you can find at bloodstreammedia.com. On that landing page, you'll see links and pictures for all our various podcasts that you can go listen to, subscribe to, and leave reviews for. Those reviews on iTunes especially do help other people find the podcast. And lastly, I do want to, again, just say thank you. This is our one-year anniversary episode. That's a cool place to be for what still sometimes feels like a new project. But at this point, we've done quite a number of podcasts through Bloodstream Media. But the year has flown by and a lot has happened. So I hope that you enjoy this one-year anniversary episode, best of year in review. Oh, and one last thing before we get to the episode, I want to say a big thank you, as always, to Shire for making the Bloodstream podcast possible. We could not do this without their generous support, and so we thank them for that. Thank you, Shire. And Natalie and I will be back next month for the June episode to kick off year two as officially Natalie and Patrick Lynch. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, enjoy this episode, a year in review on the Bloodstream podcast. Hello,
hello,
hello, and welcome to Bloodstream, episode 5432, episode 1, June 20th, 2016. I am your host, Patrick. I am Patrick James Lynch. Welcome to Bloodstream.
The situation in the world is desperate. It's truly desperate. I think the statistic that is most compelling is that about 15% of the population uses 75% of the clotting factor. That leaves 25% of the clotting factor for 85% of the world. And what that really means is that the vast majority of those 85% have no clotting factor at all. So let's go back in time, 60 years. There was no clotting factor. There was no cryoprecipitate. There was marginal fresh frozen plasma that generally caused fluid overload and congestive heart failure because it just didn't have enough factor in it to be able to stop bleeding unless you pumped hundreds of mils into patients. That's the situation we have now in the developing world, except they don't have any fresh frozen plasma either. They have nothing. They don't have ice. They don't really have access to bandages. They don't have access to casts. Certainly don't have access to braces, physical therapy. Nothing at all. In fact, in many cases, and in most cases, they're not even diagnosed with hemophilia. The median age of death in the developing world where there's minimal access to product is 10. It means half the people are dead after age 10, or by age 10. People are dying on a daily basis from hemophilia in the developing world.
Have there been any incidents that have been even somewhat frightening or scary with regard to the hemophilia?
Not specifically with hemophilia.
just general mountain scariness?
Yeah, there's been some moments where I was just like, what am I doing up here? Like, this is really uncomfortable, you know.
Like, what are some of the, what are the stories?
One of them was we were coming down from the summit of Denali, and this storm kind of came in pretty quickly, and it was just a whiteout. We kind of describe it as like hiking in a cotton ball. It's just white everywhere. And we were coming down and we couldn't even see. You put these little bamboo wands in the snow to like mark your trail because it's just white and you know, it's hard to keep. There's no like defined trail.
Right. You need to like leave your own breadcrumbs and markers along the way.
And they're generally like 15, 20 feet apart. And we couldn't find the next one. You know, it was just that dense. I actually turned around on the rope and I could barely see the person standing behind me, and they were only like 30 feet away, and I could just see the rope kind of going there, and there's a third person on our rope that was completely gone, like couldn't see him at all, and that was scary, but luckily the clouds broke just enough that we could pick up our trail again and start moving. But
in situations like that, how do you, you know, talking about going to the gym or just being physically active with hemophilia and navigating that line between pushing yourself in a safe and productive way and pushing yourself beyond what you should be.
Yeah.
When you're on a mountain, like who makes that call? Is that the guide who's the one that has to say, like, you know what, we may have to turn around here?
Sometimes. They're definitely more concerned about the weather, and they've been on these mountains before, so they understand the weather a little bit more than I would know. So they would make that call, but, you know, it's really important for, like, if I'm not feeling good, I have to communicate that to the guy and say, like, you know, I think I'm done today and I need to turn around, which I haven't had to do yet. There's been moments where I've felt like I should, maybe, or not like I should, but it was questionable. I was tired and pretty burnt out. But that's just kind of mountaineering in general, is like being in that miserable state and like trying to just
battling
yourself.
Yeah. No, this is fun. I'm having a good time. Yeah. Everything's fine.
They call it type 2 fun. You know,
type 2 fun?
Yeah, so type 1 fun's like roller coasters, it's awesome. Instantaneous like adrenaline rush. Type 2 is like, oh, that was kind of uncomfortable, but I'm really glad I did it. Like, that was good, I'd probably do it again. And then there's type 3 fun, which is like, oh, I'm really glad I did that, but I never want to do it again. And I've been borderline, like type 2.5, I guess. That was Denali in Alaska. That was like almost a 3, but...
My first World Congress, so far it's amazing. You know, when I got here and registered, it felt like a standard conference. Then I walked in the room and the sheer number of people representing people with hemophilia and other bleeding disorders from all over the world was starting to give me, I think, my first really sense of scope, which I really made me think about what are the numbers that we work with so often domestically in the US, and really how many people are affected by bleeding disorders globally. If I walked away right now, I would take away a significant change in how I look at the work that we need to do going forward in our company.
My name is Mufin Fujil.
My name is Kyle Fujil.
My name is Issa Ali, and I'm the president of our NMO Trinidad and Tobago. My friend here, Kyle, he has inhibitors, and he broke his two legs and is unable to have an operation because we cannot afford to pay to stabilize him.
That happened in 2012, so I've been battling through that for 4 years now. Because of our country economy and the state, moving around in a wheelchair is very hard.
Over the years, you find that he had been acquiring a lot of bleeding in terms of his shoulders because the effort he has to put into the turning of the chair. I'm very happy that the Bear Feature have been assisting us, and we hope that we'll continue with this sort of partnership.
Not every woman experiences carriership in the same way. And this variability in self-perception and self-awareness and self-care, I think, is inherent to all women who have medical problems, especially mothers who have medical problems. And here in this disease, imagine yourself as a mother who has a child that's affected with severe hemophilia, and she's focused instead of on her heavy menstrual bleeding and her neuropsychological manifestations of iron deficiency and her exhaustion from her anemia, she's focused on her son. This is something that's not unique to hemophilia carriers. This is something that occurs to every mother. And I think that it's important for us to ensure that women are empowered and focused on themselves so that they can better care for themselves, but also better care for their family members.
In a piece here that I've left unscripted, last week the bleeding disorders community was shocked by the sudden news of the passing of Matt Stinger. Matt had hemophilia. I had just recently cleared hepatitis and was 33 years old. Matt will be remembered for his incredible energy and work at camp up at Double H, his work as a nurse at Double H and elsewhere, and as a service provider with a specialty pharmacy serving people with bleeding disorders. But more than any of that, Matt will be remembered for his friendship, his kindness, his graciousness, his enigmatic personality, and his genuine love of people. Matt cared. He cared a lot. And he was my first friend in the bleeding disorders community. You see, the camp that Matt and I belonged to growing up was for kids with all kinds of chronic illnesses, an experience that I'm extremely thankful for, but outside of my brother, Matt was the only friend that I had with hemophilia. And when I made the transition from camper to counselor, counselor to unit leader to returning volunteer, it was always following in the footsteps and model of Matt. In fact, many times over the years at camp, volunteers, campers, and I'm sure at times even staff members confused the two of us for one another. Something that I hope he took as a compliment as much as I did. And in 2010 and 2011, when I was shifting my focus in life, it was Matt who pulled me into the bleeding disorders community, specifically. And it was Matt who introduced me to people who are now my friends. And it was Matt who introduced me to people who helped launch programs like Stop the Bleeding and Helping Hanny and the Impact Awards and Powering Through. It was Matt who got all of that started. And selfishly, I'm thankful that just 2 weeks ago at annual meeting, we had a nice long opportunity to catch up in depth. And I got to tell him for the first time thoroughly how much I appreciate him for doing that for me, for bringing me in and giving me the opportunity to serve, just like Matt was always looking for the opportunity to serve. I'll take comfort knowing I got to say that to him, obviously having no idea when I saw him looking so healthy, so vibrant, and so positive, that would be the last time we spoke. And I'm thankful that when I heard news of his death just a couple weeks later, I was at Double H with mutual friends and with some of his young mentees from CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, a couple of whom I had spent the week working beside. I'm thankful that we all had each other to hold and cry with and process with when that shocking news first hit. I'd like to think Matt was pleased to know that as well, that we had each other. It's only been a few days, so I guess I don't mind admitting that I don't have a satisfying place to leave this. Man. I'm still really sad. So I guess in closing, I'll share something that community member and friend Ryan Seeley pointed out, and that is the last thing that Matt shared on his Facebook wall the morning of August 14th. And it's this quote: "Build someone up, put their insecurities to sleep, remind them they're worthy. Tell them they're magical. Be light in a too often dim world." I love you, Matt, wherever you are. Thank you for building me up. Thank you for building Adam up. And thank you for making all whose lives you touched better. You will be missed. And you will be loved.
So I couldn't really play sports growing up, obviously. So music was a really safe thing for me to do, and it was a good outlet for me to channel all that extra energy I had that I couldn't really put into physical activities as much as I could have if I didn't have a bleeding disorder. With that being said, I've had a different perspective all my life, and I've been different than every other kid I knew. And I think with a chronic illness, you're different, you know, and you have different experiences and you see life in a different way. And whether, if it's not me, it's my friends, or it's you know, the kids in the oncology unit next door, it's perspective. So that's invaluable. As a musician, it is a constant in the back of my head. You know, I'm touring. I just got off a 2-month tour in the 42 states, 15,000 miles.
Where are the 42 states?
Where are the hemophilia treatment centers? You know, do I have my factor? Is everything okay? I'm getting a nosebleed in the bathroom in the hotel room. My buddy Kyle's figuring out what to do. You know, it's like, there's little things and it happens. But for me, it's always been a motivation, just kind of, I could use music as a platform. I've always kind of seen that as like my duty.
As an outsider to the community, I'm talking to, you know, I was 21, I mean, I met Vanessa, she was 18. I'm hearing about hemophilia, it's a part of her life and how her brother has her hemophilia. And I also heard about her, you know, going to camp back at Big Bear in California, and how every year people would come to camp and the next year they might not be there because they got sick, they had the co-infection with HIV, didn't make it back the next year. And that was a really, you know, as a new person first hearing about hemophilia, that was pretty strange and scary and freaky. So it's crazy how my perception has changed from day one as a complete outsider just hearing about it from my wife-to-be, versus now I'm a hemophilia dad, my wife's a moderate hemophiliac. I have a totally different perspective.
You were a dancer for a long time and throughout college, and Jason, what was it like for you in college when you were watching her do something she loved but kind of sacrificing a little bit of her body to do it?
Seeing her get a bleed, you know, having to sit out, that was the hardest. It was very hard for her, and as her boyfriend or husband, you want to be there and say, gee, I'm sorry, I'm here for you, what can I do? And I think it's, now that I have two boys, you know, we try not to limit them for the same reason. I think perhaps in response to what I saw from Vanessa, when she couldn't dance. She had to miss a nutcracker. She had to miss something because of a bleed. So I see my 6-year-old now, my 2-year-old here, both severe, they're both on prophylactic. And we try not to limit them. We want them to have the normal kid experience and not have to be the kid sitting on the playground where everybody else is getting to do what they want to do.
When I was approximately 11 or 12 years old, the foundation down here, they had a C camp, but there was one line in the application that said that you had to be a boy. So I actually remember calling the phone number on the form and saying, hey, I have a bleeding disorder, but I'm a girl, and I wanted to know if it was still possible for me to come. And I was actually able to go, so that was like the first time that I remember pushing for anything and then realizing like, well, maybe this is the way I have to go. Like, otherwise, I'm never going to get to go to any of these events. And I still have a bleeding disorder, so I should be able to go. I wanted to meet other women and to be able to tell my story and talk to other people and see what other people were dealing with. The perception was different even from the medical community, where it was only boys who had bleeding disorders. So
yeah.
I've been able to see that change.
By you saying, hey, I want to go to sea camp, I have a bleeding disorder, I'm just like these boys, you're helping yourself go to sea camp, but you're also just helping women with bleeding disorders, right? Like, sometimes advocating for the self is really advocating for a much larger population than you might realize. Being a woman who's an advocate and an outspoken person, do you find any sort of obstacles or barriers that you think gender kind of plays a role in?
The perception of women a lot of the times in these spaces can be sort of overdramatic or hysterical, something along those lines. And sort of having people like you be able to speak out and be able to be a part of these communities in a totally rational, sort of equal player kind of way helps to sort of take that stigma away, I think, from the experience of women living with these illnesses and living with these diseases. So yes, absolutely.
And Bobby, in your experience as a woman, how have you found things to be?
It's getting better. It's getting better.
It's getting better.
Just want to take a quick time out from our anniversary episode to once again thank the sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast, Shire. I was popping around Shire's website earlier today, and in the bleeding disorders section, they have a list of community organizations that may be of use for resources and information for patients, families, and caregivers. HFA is on there, NHF is on there, the World Federation, WFH, is on there, and the European Hemophilia Consortium. And I've heard about the European Hemophilia Consortium and see their name listed before, but I've never actually clicked on their website or on the link and bounced around their site to see the news that they're putting out or the way that they've interpreted developments in our community. Anyway, I found their website kind of interesting. There's also links to their various social media platforms, and it was a reminder that there are always more organizations than we might be aware of who are also looking out for the best interests of people around the world living with bleeding disorders. So if you, like me, are interested in various outlets for information in our community, maybe check out the European Hemophilia Consortium website, which is ehc.eu, and see if anything there strikes you. Thank you, Shire, for making me aware of ehc.eu, and thank you, Shire, for sponsoring the Bloodstream podcast. Okay, back to the episode. As stated by one credible expert, there has been such a history of false optimism and false hope with HIV. So it seems like there's enough articles circulating on the reasons that while this headline about a man cured of HIV is engaging and certainly encouraging for this study, it's not the full story. And one could argue, some have, it's a little misleading. Either way, it signifies that this study is definitely one worth following. But the other point that this brings up for me, and it's something that today's sit-down guest, Jeannie White Ginder, and I spoke about off mic, the fight to stop the spread of AIDS has not ended. Yes, there are encouraging headlines about treatment developments such as this one. Yes, Magic Johnson is alive and well, and it can be easy to think that the AIDS pandemic is over. It's not. It's simply quieter. Has progress been made in the treatment and management of HIV/AIDS? Absolutely. Are there exciting treatments and potential cures being worked on? Sure are. But let me just read you a few sobering statistics from AMFAR, the American Foundation for AIDS Research, an organization whose inaugural fundraiser was co-hosted by actress Elizabeth Taylor and Jeannie White Ginder's son, Ryan White. So a couple stats from AMFAR. In 2015, worldwide, 36.7 million people were living with HIV. In 2015, worldwide, 2.1 million people were newly infected with HIV. 150,000 of those under the age of 15. Every day, about 5,753 people contract HIV. That's about 240 people an hour. And in case you're thinking that while this is a big ongoing worldwide problem, but not specifically a United States problem, think again. Approximately 1.1 million Americans are living with HIV/AIDS, and more than 50,000 become infected with HIV every year. 50,000. 50. And perhaps even more startling, 25% of those newly infected are between the ages of 13 and 24. That means at least one teenager or young adult in this country is infected with HIV every hour of every day. And I'm not running through these numbers to scare you or to be dramatic. I'm stating these numbers because they scare me. They're dramatic and they are shocking to me. And for that reason, I want to understand them. Have we gotten complacent because treatment has gotten strong and consistent? Has product development and chronic care management made HIV/AIDS less scary and therefore less talked about? Are we just tired of it? Why are teens and young adults becoming infected with HIV in the United States at these rates? If we compare the spread of HIV in the US today to, say, Zika, I just stated in 2015 there were 50,050 new cases of HIV in the US. To date, there have been 3,818 cases of Zika reported to the CDC. And one big asterisk on that figure, only 105 of those cases were acquired domestically, and all of those were in Florida. Sorry, Florida. The rest are labeled as travel-related cases. If news broke today that a chronic, life-threatening virus called the human immunodeficiency virus was infecting, on our soil, 50,000 Americans per year, including 12,500 teenagers and people under the age of 25, can you imagine the degree of urgency that would surround stopping that spread? Well, maybe if we look back 25 or 30 years, we know exactly what that would look like. When I sat down with Jeannie Weikinder, she had just returned from a trip to Georgia, and even she was startled to learn about the rampant spread of HIV in the particular part of Georgia that she was visiting. So, in honor of Jeannie's appearance on this episode, in honor of the work her son Ryan White did to educate about and destigmatize HIV/AIDS, and in honor of the tens of thousands of people with hemophilia and their loved ones who contracted HIV through contaminated product, just like Ryan, let us remember the fight is not over. 25% of new cases of HIV in the US in 2015 occurred in people 13 to 24. 25%. These are children and young adults. Let's not forget that the battle is not yet won. There is still much more work to do. I want to read a selection of words that I picked out from some stuff that has been written about Ryan, characteristics, and just kind of get your take on these. Blunt, disarming, normal, wise, graceful, quick thinking, steely resolve, effective, determined, stubborn, poised, relentlessly upbeat. Do those sound accurate? You're smiling. Do those sound generally accurate to you?
I think spoiled was in there somewhere too. But Ryan had charm. He had charm, but I think because of the way he dealt with everything, he didn't dwell on his disease. He dwelt on doing things and having a future. And so I don't think that, you know, I think he had all those qualities, but at the same time, I think he was really sincere in, he really wanted to go to school. And I can remember the attorney asking Ryan, you know, do you really want to go to school that bad? And Ryan said, yes. He said, it could get ugly. Ryan said, I can take it. So I think the more challenges that was put in front of him, the more he fought to achieve those.
Well, and in reading his book, he references how living with hemophilia, he had been living all his life with a disorder that made him different, mm-hmm. that meant he had to go about life a little bit differently, that he was going to struggle to participate in things like sports in a big sports state like Indiana. And I can identify with that because I feel like the hemophilia-related challenges that I had, especially as a kid when I had inhibitors and was bleeding a lot, missed a lot of school, had trouble keeping friendships because I was gone so much, I think that's prepared me well for challenges that you face in life. Obviously, I've never faced something like what Ryan has. Very few people will. But it does help prepare you. And I hear families talk about that. how having hemophilia and learning how to manage it teaches you about how much strength that you have and how much resolve you truly have, because it's a necessity.
I think with Ryan being and having severe hemophilia with less than 1% clotting, I think by being in the hospital at Riley Hospital and seeing kids a lot worse off than him growing up. I mean, when you're 4 and 5 years old and you see kids who are mentally, physically handicapped. Mm-hmm. And Ryan used to say, I'm just thankful all that's wrong with my hemophilia. And then to keep growing up with hemophilia, I mean, he saw constantly kids worse off than him. And it takes a special thing in your life, I think, that I'm just grateful, you know, right, that my hemophilia. Then you learn to deal with hemophilia. And all of a sudden something else comes along and it's like, oh, brother, he said, well, this is just something else I got to deal with.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I think instead of completely feeling sorry for yourself, you know, think, how am I going to live with this? How mm-hmm. am I going to deal with this? You mm-hmm. know, how am I going to be able to carry on my life the way I am?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that instead of being negative, oh, feel sorry for me, or I can't believe this has happened to me. I think that was never Ryan's attitude. It's just, well, this is something else I got to deal with.
With some of these underrepresented minorities, like the disabled community, it's difficult to see somebody who's not disabled play these disabled characters, and they're doing a beautiful job. Some of these people are winning awards, but there is a layer of truth that they would never be able to bring to the part.
Mm-hmm.
But what about emotional and intellectual disabilities? Is that also our responsibility to represent those authentically? And if it is, what responsibility do we have to that community to support them in doing these roles?
Right.
So it is...
Gets very complex quickly.
It's complex. But I do, as where I am in my career, I do think that we need people who have disabilities playing these roles. And they don't need to be written as disabled characters. They can just be characters that happen to have disabilities as well. I also always make the argument that if we turned on the TV and saw a kid on Nickelodeon in blackface, it would be outrageous.
Right.
But, you know, all the time people are sitting in wheelchairs or acting as if they're blind or an amputee when they're not.
Right, right, right.
So where do you draw the line? And when do we begin to create content where it's not specific to the disability, but we're casting people with disabilities in those roles?
On December 1st, the National AIDS Memorial Grove held their annual World AIDS Day observance ceremony. The Grove's Unsung Hero Award was presented this year to Jeannie White Ginder, who accepted on behalf of the hemophilia community. In addition to her being there, NHF CEO Val Bias, HFA CEO Kimberly Hogstad, and COT President Carl Wexler, along with other community leaders, were also on hand for this historic moment. According to CDC data, approximately 90% of people with severe hemophilia A contracted HIV and/or hepatitis C between the late 70s and the late 80s. For many years, there has been a call for a monument to recognize the crisis or Holocaust that was experienced by the hemophilia community during this time. The National AIDS Memorial Grove, in addition to presenting the hemophilia community with the Unsung Hero Award, also unveiled plans for what they call a seated crescent, which will be a monument to memorialize the hemophilia community's unique role, albeit unintended, in identifying HIV/AIDS as a bloodborne virus and disease. In a letter that was circulated in the last couple of days, NHF CEO Val Bias recognized the importance of this day, World AIDS Day 2016, the importance of this monument being established. He also recognized that while HFA and NHF have put up a substantial amount of money to get this monument started, there are still funds needed to complete its sustainability. And there has been a call for a second monument that would potentially live somewhere on the East Coast or at the very least outside of a pre-existing memorial such as the National AIDS Grove. In the letter I just referenced, NHF's CEO Val Bias did acknowledge that NHF would be willing to work with HFA and COT not only on raising the additional funds necessary for the monument in the AIDS Memorial Grove, but also on raising the funds for a second monument if that is to move forward. I do think it's important that we continue to just stay aware, and I see what took place on December 1st of this year as an excellent example of coming together to discuss our community's darkest days and how we come out of that. Not with unending bitterness and not with unending anger and sadness. Of course, there is an element of that that will always be present for some, and rightfully so, but with a sense of purpose and a sense of forward-looking. And I am encouraged moving into 2017, a year where I think days like Advocacy Days, Washington Days, our National Advocacy Day in DC, our state advocacy days that take place all throughout the calendar year. These are going to be particularly important days as the Affordable Care Act is under threat and 30 million Americans, including those of us with chronic diseases, need to reconcile that. So I'm encouraged by the coming together of these organizations and the sense of looking forward to how we continue to learn lessons and advocate as a unit.
When I think about challenges that we potentially are going to face, I think it is going to become more and more a priority for us to get our voices heard. And at a local level, I would like to have more of my families locally involved with that advocacy conversation and making sure that they're telling their stories both on the state level and also nationally. Most people have spent time on the phone with an insurance agent trying to navigate a problem, trying to get what they need. That's a common experience that people can relate to. But if you tell that story to someone, they may not understand why they need the medicine. They may not understand the technicalities related to why this medicine is important for bleeding disorders, but they can understand that common frustration. I think that's what stories do, is it brings it down to that common level that you can relate to. If we are going to be effective as organizations, advocates, or whatever, the best way we can do it is unify as a community. When you look back at the history of how advocacy has been effective for this community, it's when we've all come together and had one voice.
I do think that people need to be prepared for advocacy whether they want to or not. That's where the foundations can provide training and opportunity. I think the final thing I'd just like to say is we celebrated World Hemophilia Day, but to me, it's not really a celebration when 95% of the world's bleeding disorder population is not getting access to medication that could allow them to live normal and fulfilled lives. So I think that there is an obligation on us in this country to somehow make a change and effort to reach those people.
For me, it's really hard to wrap my head around the fact that we're talking about gene therapy cures for our folks here in the States, and yet I personally get phone calls and Facebook requests from people who have nothing to treat their bleeds. And it just breaks my heart, and I feel like we have an obligation to do something about that.
I'm really excited about the leadership our board is taking to grow BDAI. The board is really looking at what they can do to raise more money for our organization. And they're doing it in a way that I think is very smart. They are looking at growing our funding by growing our leaders. And so not only, you know, they don't want to do this just at the board level, they want to do it across the organization. So they've created this plan to recruit what they're calling the Group of 20. It's a dream of mine that we get people to recognize that they own these organizations, and that if they're going to keep them strong and they're going to keep them alive, it's going to be because of their investments. By becoming more efficient, we'll all be more effective.
We've been talking for a little while about wanting to bring in a co-host, someone to kind of help make your experience as a listener a bit more interesting, represent a different perspective on bleeding disorders and health and what the value of content like this could mean. we have made a choice, and I am thrilled to be able to introduce you to the new co-host of Bloodstream. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't tell, but I'm doing finger drumstick drum rolls right now. The new co-host of Bloodstream, the Bloodstream podcast, is none other than Miss Natalie Rose DeLillo. Hello, Natalie.
Hi, Patrick. I'm certainly excited to be here. I do think I will offer a unique perspective being a support, soon-to-be wife of someone with bleeding disorder, and I'm excited to be a part of Bloodstream.
Sickle cell disease is a hereditary blood disorder that causes red blood cells, usually circular-shaped, to mutate into a sickle or crescent shape. Usually, healthy red blood cells help carry oxygen all over your body thanks to a protein called hemoglobin. People with normal hemoglobin have red blood cells that are round and smooth, so the oxygen molecules can easily attach to them. With sickle cell disease, the carrier has a genetically inherited mutation to their hemoglobin, and the body starts producing red blood cells that are mutated and rigid, so the oxygen molecules can no longer attach to them. These sickled cells become stuck in blood vessels, causing a crisis of pain in various parts of the body. They can also lead to fevers, swelling, and in more severe cases, things like a stroke or osteonecrosis, bone death. Patients often make trips to the hospital to receive narcotics to ease the pain or antibiotics to treat infections. Sickle cell disease affects roughly 100,000 Americans, and approximately 2.5 million Americans carry the trait that can cause sickle cell disease. The extra care I've taken to prepare my meals and constantly drink water has actually influenced the people around me. Seeing that I could cause a positive change in other people's dietary habits has inspired me to consider a nutrition education on a more professional level and become a resource to the underserved blood disorder community. You can follow my journey at thesicklerstable.tumblr.com.
But I definitely, you know, definitely want to always try to bring as much awareness and as much as I can. I'm always looking to grow grow the nonprofit. It's not as easy as you always think. Definitely always looking to, you know, grow that on a larger scale as well. You know, do things outside of just the scholarships. And I recently, you know, partnered up with the Healthy Steps program, you know, really trying to get the initiative off the ground with the importance of physical fitness. So that's very exciting. It was a great time up in New York. We had a good time filming all the videos. And like I said, hope it catches on and, you know, become a staple in the bleeding disorder community. I would say that'd be a big thing that I'm looking forward to going forward.
Believe Limited, the digital content company I co-founded, has launched two brand new podcasts for the bleeding disorders community. Our Ask the Expert podcast series features hematologists and other healthcare experts answering listener-submitted questions about hemophilia, von Willebrand disease, and all things inherited bleeding disorders. Our first episode, which went live on January 30th, features Dr. Arash Mahajaran. He's a pediatric hematologist from the Children's Hospital of Orange County and an assistant clinical professor at the University of California, Irvine. And he answers a wide array of questions sent in by community members from all throughout the United States and the world. We launched the Powering Through podcast, which features panel conversations on obstacles, challenges, and what it takes to overcome for the benefit of the bleeding disorders community. These panels are produced during live events held all around the country, including NHF's annual meeting, HFA symposium, and regional patient organization and chapter meetings. We've had some incredible guests so far, including singer-songwriter with hemophilia Trevor Martin, television and theater actor Sam Underwood, Lyme disease and chronic illness advocate and author Ali Cashel, New York City Hemophilia Chapter President Wendy Chow, cross-country cyclist living with hemophilia and HIV Barry Hardy, and many, many others. The Bloodstream podcast is sponsored exclusively by Shire, and we want to give them a big thank you for sponsoring this content. And speaking of content, if you are looking for more content aimed at people in the bleeding disorders community or with hemophilia specifically, I recommend that maybe you take a look at Shire's YouTube channel, where you can find a few various videos, I should say, of patients and parents alike talking about their life with hemophilia, their challenges, the obstacles that they've faced, how they have redefined their life and triumphed in spite of their bleeding disorder. You can find that by looking up the Bleeding Disorders Community webpage on YouTube or following the links on Shire's social channels to their YouTube page. And again, thank you to Shire for sponsoring the Bloodstream podcast.
Addiction is not unfamiliar to me. I have been in recovery in Narcotics Anonymous, NA, for decades. My own story is one that I have told many times. I was clean for a couple of years when I had my son. When I found out he had hemophilia, it was my recovery in NA that helped me keep moving forward and gave me the courage to keep trying, even when I felt overwhelmed and scared. The story I have not told is the story of my son and how the disease of hemophilia and the pain involved led him down the path to the disease of addiction. For the purposes of this story, I'll call him Jason, though that's not his real name. I didn't see my son for 7 months. I talked with him occasionally, and time and again he would go into another recovery house and get kicked out. I would get the dreaded phone call that he was asked to leave yet another facility and begin the process of prayer and acceptance all over again. It was a daily struggle to carry on with my own life, knowing that at any time his could end. I was something of a hollow shell in my everyday existence. I went to work, but often found myself weeping in hallways or bathrooms. Each time a friend talked about their child's accomplishments, my own feelings of inadequacy compounded. I went to bleeding disorder events, pretending Jason was in Florida, starting a new life, when in reality, I often didn't even know where he was or if he was alive. I was going to another event in Florida when he called and asked me if he could come to see me. I arranged to get him to where I was. When I saw him walking towards me for the first time in months, I looked at him and I knew that he was going to die if he continued on. He asked to come home and offered me solutions for getting himself help. We reached an agreement. He had to follow through or I would send him away again. I knew this time that I would be able to do it. I had come to terms with his addiction and the possibility of his death.
I, like you, am highly concerned about many of the things that we see beginning to happen, changes in our society that are not necessarily going in the direction that I would hope. I see vulnerable populations in very difficult places, particularly immigrants and refugees and people with pre-existing conditions, which is something that affects our community. This is a time when we must all come together and we must step forward and we must come together. We can't afford to go in 1,000 different directions. We have to consolidate our efforts and laser focus our time and energy on the things that are most important to our life, like lifetime caps and pre-existing conditions, exclusions, and the Affordable Care Act. Yes, today there's 100 things that I'm worried about. And at the same time, I know that there are people with a different philosophy, with different politics, and that doesn't make them bad and that doesn't make them less intelligent. They just have a different philosophy. And if we want to be heard, we have to listen to them as well. But in the bleeding disorders community, like no time in many, many years, we have to come together. We have to talk to our chapters. We have to talk to the National Hemophilia Foundation. We'll have to talk to the Hemophilia Federation. We have to ask them for talking points. And then we have to make our voice heard. Sometimes it's difficult to conceive of picking up the telephone and calling your senator or your congressman or your mayor or any of your elected representatives. But it's not that difficult. And your chapter will help you. NHF will help you. Write down what you want to say. Practice it. Share of yourself when you call. And then call and call and call every day. I've started now 3 weeks ago calling my congressman every day. And now their staff know who I am. They know I'm going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act for a couple of minutes. They know my name. And so I know when we go to Washington days, they'll smile and they'll say, oh, is this guy again? But that is the only way in which they're going to remember how much this matters to us, how our lives are on the line. And we will win some battles and we will lose some other battles. And when we lose them, then we just get up and we fight them again and again until we win them for good. This is not going to be fast. We can't expect to have everything we want today. But we have to fight the good battle.
Washington Days 2017 is in the books.
Yes, it is.
And unfortunately, this year, neither of us were able to attend.
That's true.
You know, but Stop the Bleeding production, mm-hmm. which is exciting and has to happen.
That's
unfortunately,
true.
Conflicted with that this year.
It did. But, you know, you're never going to be able to go to every event that you want to go to for whatever cause or advocacy issue that you may be interested in. But we did cover last month on episode 9 some of the things that you can do in addition to in-person visits, making phone calls and emails and ways to kind of build your argument. It was one of our like, share, comment stories last month. So if you didn't hear episode 9, check it out on bloodstreampod.com. Look at the program notes and you can follow links to some of the resources with tips on how you can be an advocate outside of a once-a-year event. Or if you have a state hill day coming up and you want to participate on the state government level, you can look at tips for in-person visits for that purpose. But yes, Washington Days 2017 is now officially behind us.
So I'm still taking a bypassing agent, which is kind of funny. I mean, this is sort of what I was thinking of while we're talking about the projects is I have to still deal with this, right? This bleeding disorder in the context of trying to create works outside of the bleeding disorder sort of topic. So it's always with me, you know, no matter what. For me, I always still kind of see it in the work, no matter what it is, because not to say it's a bad thing, but in some ways my advantage to participating in these kinds of opportunities that other artists would just be like, yeah, cool, I can do that, you know, is different. I have to be very calculated about what I'm doing, how long I'm doing it. You know, if I'm up in the Arctic Circle and I had a head bleed, I mean, what am I going to do? So there's different steps you have to take in terms of preparedness and even additional costs, frankly, that you have to be able to cover to make sure that you can have the experience be as fruitful for yourself as possible. And I think, you know, many times that can be a frustrating experience to think, you know, look at this person, they can do whatever they want. Of course, wouldn't it be great to jet set and do whatever I wanted and abandon all of my belongings and just live out of a van or something, right? And make work about whatever. I mean, those things are sort of idealistic, but it took some time and maybe I sort of worked more through it several years ago now, but to be okay with and to understand that whatever the experience is for me is that experience and it's enough. You know, it may be different than someone else's, but it's working and it will be the best that it can be if I let it be, you know?
Today is the launch of Stop the Bleeding Season 7.
Yes, it is. It's Stop the Bleeding Season 7, our biggest season yet, 10-episode season. With each episode revolving around one central topic, which is a shift from what we've done in the past. And the topic for our World Hemophilia Day launch is, drumroll please,
World Hemophilia Day!
Hey! So, the launch episode for Season 7 is all about World Hemophilia Day and how Spencer, my character, tries to rally the ragtag group of healthcare workers that are at Stop the Bleeding to caring about hemophilia around the globe. Really proud of how the episode came out. You know, when you talk about hemophilia around the world, 75% of people don't have access to care. Half of people with severe hemophilia die before age 10. These are heavy things to kind of come to grips with, and it's hard.
And to make funny.
And, you know, we spend a lot of time figuring out how can we do this in a way that's both sensitive and respectful, but entertaining, because if it's not entertaining, we're not fulfilling the promise of what that program is intended to be. And I have to say, I think we did really, really well.
That's a hard balance.
It is. And our second episode is on insurance and advocacy, which is another thing, like, how do you make this interesting and funny? But, you know, look, I not to be too, like, you know, patting ourselves on the back, we know what we're doing, and we've gotten really good at it, and we have good people working on it, so they've come out really, really well.
You, one of your days... took a van ride and then ended up having to walk to the family's house that you were meeting with.
Yeah. Well, we took a van ride until the van got stuck in the mud.
Right, right. Well, I was going to let you share that part.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, there you go.
You're just used to being the interviewer. Let me do my job, please.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
So you've expressed to me that that was your best day. Can you share with our audience a little bit what was so magical about that day?
Yeah, we were driving there, and as we were driving there, as the road started to get thinner and thinner, and we started to be like, where does this guy live? I mean, we knew we were going outside the city. We knew he was far away from the hospital and access to medicine. But the further out we got, I mean, it was beautiful, but you know, you also start like thinking, this guy's got hemophilia, and where does he live? And sure enough, at one point, the road was so muddy and just the van got stuck. So we were going to have to walk at a certain point anyway to get to his house because he just lives like up a mountain a little bit. But we had to get out prematurely when the van got stuck in the mud. So we had about an hour's hike ahead of us with all of our gear through this just, you could probably use better descriptors than I can, but it was just like this magical, it felt like a magical like jungle prairie. I don't even know what to call it. Just go to Bombardier Blood, watch the video. It's a stunning sight. This guy, Babesh, 18 years old, lives up there with his mom and his family. And we were asking, you know, what do you do when you get a bleed? Because like as beautiful as the walk was, it was really tough, both up and down. And like I said, it took us an hour to get up. And that was once we got off the main road, which was at least an hour from the hospital. And sure enough, he had recently been in the hospital. I think it was 3 weeks prior he said he had been. And when he needed to get down to the road, his mom carries him. And he's an 18-year-old. He's not a 4-year-old. And that's just what you have to do. It was an absolutely stunning place. And that same day, we went on to visit two other families at their homes in different kinds of settings. All three, you know, very poor. It's a very poor country. All three had homes that were damaged, if not ruined, by the earthquake. One family, the Umkushna, him and his family of, I think it's like 6 people living in a shed that we here in the States would maybe like use for the lawnmower and like a few bicycles. That's where all 6 of them live because their home was destroyed in the earthquake and they don't have money to build a new home. So they live in that shed, and when he has bleeds, and he showed us his knee, it's quite damaged. He's had many bleeds. He just has to be in that shed. In that tin shed, and that's in the summer and the hottest days of the year. Just a stunning sight, a very sobering sight to see. But that was our day of home visits, and that was just one of the most magical days. It was one of the most magical days that I've ever experienced.
So after these visits with these families and being in Nepal, is there anything outside of medicine that you have discovered is a need in the developing world?
Money. I mean, they have nothing. The average salary is like $120, $130 a month. I'm being casual, $130 a month. That's the average salary. So they just don't have much at all. Refrigeration, I mean, we talk about rice, rest, ice, compression, elevation. Like, they don't have ice.
Ice is a luxury.
You're not getting ice. Like, where's the ice coming from? Everything's a luxury. It's very minimalist living. And what's really interesting too, something I hadn't really thought about before, and it's similar in the States in a way, if you live in Kathmandu, again, it's one of the most polluted cities in the world, but it's where the hospital is. And we talked to some older guys with hemophilia because miraculously they have some older guys with severe hemophilia, older guys being guys in their 40s and early 50s, which unfortunately is rare. In the developing world with severe hemophilia. And they live in the city, you know, and it's polluted and it's crowded and it's in many ways unpleasant, but it's nearer to the hospital. So when they get bleeds, they want to be closer to where the factor is. Whereas if you go out to where Babesh lives, it is absolutely stunning, but you are very far away from care. So it's a trade-off. And that was something I wasn't quite aware of. But yeah, I mean, honestly, in terms of like what the needs are beyond medicine, everything is a need.
I could say that we have about 65 countries who are we consider them developing countries, that we work with them for our humanitarian aid program, that we donate to them factor concentrate or clotting factor concentrate to use for their patients, particularly those who have no access to treatment products.
The humanitarian aid program of WFH was initiated in 1996. And between 1996 and 2015, we were able to send roughly 270 million of IUs to countries and to people in need all over the world.
The vision of the WFS is to have treatment for all. And treatment for all means accurate diagnosis for every person with bleeding disorders, sufficient treatment for everybody who has hemophilia, and at the same time extend this for other bleeding disorder. This is our vision.
The problem of hemophilia in Africa is a great problem. We have many undiagnosed patients, and when the patients are diagnosed, they have no access to treatment.
At this period in 1968, there is no knowledge about factor concentrates. They have no information about the technique of rice. They have no information about the danger of aspirin.
I've always said the humanitarian aid for me in my country is the difference between life and death. In 2004, I went online and searched Hemophilia Foundations, and I saw 67 organizations. I went back home and I wrote my story and sent it to all 67.
And 67 all around the world?
All around the world. And 3 days after, I got an email from Assad saying, your son's story has been flying from every corner of the world. Send me your phone number so that I can call you. And he called and asked, explained my situation. I got the first donation of treatment products from the WFH July 12, 2004. Today we have 218 identified persons with hemophilia. When I started, there was no patient support group. There was nobody for you to talk to. Today, families have a network of someone you can call who can share your experience. When I started, we didn't have physiotherapists who knew anything about hemophilia. Diagnosis was zero. We're paying as much as $300 to $400 to get diagnosed. Today, because of the work we are doing together with the WFH, diagnosis is free. When I started, healthcare providers were like skeptical that hemophilia was not a black man's disease. Today we are beginning to make them believe that it's a black man's disease and has been living with us. Most developing countries share the same thing I experienced in my country. From sub-Saharan Africa to Southeast Asia, we have developing countries who are in the same range. If the World Federation's data says just 25% of persons with hemophilia receive adequate care, 75 receive low or no care at all, and that's where my country falls.
I wanted to be a priest, and the reason why I wanted to be a priest was because I wanted to give back to society. And when I failed to do that and I completed my medical training, I noted that there was one area of patient, you know, group of patients that had been left out. If you are diagnosed with hemophilia, it was as good as being sentenced to death. The problem actually was not the disease, right. It was more of management and availability of resources. That was what was creating the difference. So in my setup, hemophilia was death. In other setups, you know, it was just a challenge. Treatment for hemophilia, for example, is very expensive. In my setup, for you to get medication for 3 days, you would sell land, you know? So I don't know for how many pieces of land you would have to sell to treat yourself. It's almost impossible. It's as good as being told, sorry, we don't need you.
One of the biggest challenges we face is the inadequacy of enough treatment products. There are times that we run out of products, and it's not because the WFH does not want to give, but it's because that is all they have. And there could be life-threatening bleeds that will come at that point in time.
Whatever we were getting actually was amounting to a 0.006 units per capita. Now that simply means it was so little,
insufficient.
But as little as it was still able to sustain lives. When I came back after my training, one of the first people I met was Dr. Assad. He was able to guide me on the things that he felt we needed to do. And frankly speaking, we've had a lot of achievements. One as a country, and possibly secondly, also, you know, our relationship with WFH. Because initially, I'll tell you that drugs were coming in so erratically. There was nothing that was predictable. You had clinicians coming for training, but then after the training, people are just left hopeless. You don't know what to do with a patient. But then for the last 1 year or so, we've had some very structured plans, one for our country and for patients, and basically even for the region, because we are now doing much more than just supporting our country.
Have you had moments where you've wanted to throw your hands in the air? Or?
So many times. I've had sleepless nights. I've been called at 2 a.m. of a child who fell at 10 o'clock and 10 p.m. and the mother called me at 2 a.m. There was nothing I could do. By 6 a.m. when I will call back to ask what I could do, the boy was dead. And that breaks my heart.
1 in 1,000 people around the world live with a bleeding disorder. The majority have no access to treatment.
Half the people with hemophilia in the developing world have died by the time they're 10. That's a staggering statistic, considering that the lifespan of those of us with hemophilia in the developed world is close to normal.
And with that, Natalie, we are coming up on the end of our episode here, which, as you just said earlier before we started, this is the last time you'll be telling people that your name's Natalie DeLillo, because...
Because next month, I will be a married woman.
You will. So Natalie and I are getting married next month.
And I'm changing my last name.
She is. She's giving up DeLillo for Lynch. I think DeLillo's a cooler last name, but, you know, we're not going to get into the whole reason behind this. That being said, this is the last time you're going to be saying that. And with that, that is all for this episode of Bloodstream. Don't forget to check out the bloodstreammedia.com website, bloodstreammedia.com, and subscribe to the Ask the Expert Empowering Through podcast series, as well as our brand new Bloodline series, kicking off with our VWD deep dive. You'll hear all of Bloodstream Media's podcasts for the bleeding disorders community at bloodstreammedia.com. And if you have a question for Ask the Expert or an idea for a future episode, please email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on Facebook, facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. This episode of Bloodstream was written by Patrick James Lynch and Natalie DeLillo, produced by Patrick James Lynch, Ryan Geelan, Rob Bradford, Andrew Gall, Josh Bragg, Ava Friedman, and Colby Crow, and the Bloodstream podcast is edited by Mr. Andrew Gall. Special thanks to everybody at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, and Shire, our supporter, through an unrestricted educational grant. And special thanks as well to everyone who has helped make these first episodes as strong and fantastic as they are. A reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories and topics featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And for the last time, I'm Natalie DeLillo.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself.